Hi, folks. Before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward with our guest, Dr. Rob Cromarty, Ben and I, last week, we recorded our first episode in our new recording studio that we're using, which will be out in a week or two. And it was fab. We had a lovely time. It sounds great. We had some very able help from the wonderful producer Angie in the room, which is hopefully going to make the sound quality of these episodes even better, and it's going to make our lives easier rather than hopping around from our own back rooms and people's shed offices and things like that. So we want to let you know that that is being covered by our Patreon donors, the people who have donated to the show. Your money goes towards the subscriptions we have with Libsyn and our very website hosts, and now towards this studio that we're using. And we have estimated that it now costs about $20 an episode if we do one of these a week for the whole year. So that's where the Patreon money goes. You guys, if you don't donate to us on Patreon and you've been thinking about it, or you enjoy what we do and you want to help us out in some way, you too could be a member of our gang of little sugar daddies and mummies by helping us cover those costs. If you visit patreon.com/worstfootforward and you can join that merry band and receive extra exclusive content a month, suggest episode topics, become a judge on the show. We're going to be having a few of those on in the next few weeks, hopefully. So, and obviously when we reach certain tiers, we are now, from now on, we're going to release an extra episode a month, making yet more rods for our backs, and we're aiming towards working on a live show and a book, even of the show as well. So if more and more of you want to chip in and help us out, that's where that extra cash will be going towards. So that's patreon.com/worstfootforward. As ever, you can find us in the usual places on Twitter, at worstfoot on Facebook. Send us an email to worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com or visit worstfootforwardpodcast.com for all our previous episodes. Now, sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode about the world's worst military tactics.
Welcome to Worst Foot Forward, their podcast where each week we celebrate the best of the worst. And this week you find me and my co-host atop our steeds, atop the tallest hill overlooking the plains of an unnamed county as we watch our troops go into battle against the opposition. But I think we're going to get the better of them because we've put our heads together and we're using the pincer movement. That's right, we have armed each and every one of our soldiers with the pincers of an ant. I think it's going to go... Oh no, they're all dead. They're all totally dead, guys. I'm so sorry. Oh, I'm so sorry. And with me is the cardigan to my charge of the Light Brigade. Barry McStay.
I think of myself as the cardigan to your slippers. Yeah. How are you? You feeling better since last week?
Yeah, do you know what? 7 days off has really helped. I don't feel quite as bad.
That's good, because you need an iron stomach for this week, so we're going to get a bit gruesome with military tactics.
I think we are.
So what else have we done? Because we did World's Worst General way back in like episode 8 or something with James Rowland. Yeah. So it's nice to go back and... revisit the military.
yeah, it is. Well, it's because at first, when I started researching for this one, some of the old favourite names came up, and it turns out that the level of military incompetence throughout history does not just stay at general level.
Yeah, it's a bit more general than that.
yes, it absolutely is. Should we introduce our guest?
Yes, our guest this week is the head of classics at Wellington College, a PhD, and contributor to A-level support texts on ancient history. If you're an 18-year-old in need of the answer to such questions as how did Augustus affect the Roman constitution, why was the Roman Republic doomed to fail, and how did the Flavians reinvent the imperial image, well, then he's the man for you. Also, if you're an 18-year-old studying classics, let Ben and I be a cautionary tale to you all. He's also a self-confessed sci-fi nerd, archaeologist, and ginger, ticking several of the demographic boxes for this podcast in one go. He's an alumnus of the brilliant BBC quiz show Only Connect as a member of the Beaks, who went out in a nail-biting tiebreaker late in Series 13. A Series 1, of course, by a team led by past guest of the show, Lydia Meisen. No doubt our guest is out to go one better than her this time, but it will be hard because her candidate did win her episode on this show. It's like she's just taunting you now. Be prepared for some very mild and nerdy smack talk from the classy classicist, Dr. Rob Cromarty.
Hello, gents. Nice to be here. Happy to be here up in London talking to two such erudite and handsome young men.
Now, let me stop you there.
I'm lying.
You come in here banding words around words we don't understand.
Handsome. It's probably not what you hear that often, you know.
Yeah, it's fine. It's very, very 19th century word. I'll take erudite and look it up.
Yeah. Yet again, by the way, just occasionally comes up on the show. Watch the show Only Connect, Ben and I, big fans. And you were robbed, Rob.
Well, thank you very much.
Saying Rob before, his were the team I wanted to win that series.
Oh, don't tell Lydia that.
It's fine, she won anyway. She doesn't.
She's got the trophy, she's got the glory.
Yeah.
I mean, what we've got is the fan base. That's better.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like, but it's mad.
Fan favourites.
Only Connect really does have a very passionate fan base.
Yeah, like crazy to some extent, because I mean, I was on there with my two best friends, Dan and Aidan, mm-hmm. and they're a married couple, and there's so much online chatter about, oh, those two brothers are getting on very well. and you just, how do you break it to somebody? Not quite that kind of relationship.
Yeah, that's the risk with a nice little tea time quiz.
Yeah.
Slano, Paul Sinnott's only been gay for 6 months.
Well.
So you went to Wellington School, which I didn't realise until now. That's Wellington in Somerset, which is a boarding school. So no, you teach at Wellington School.
No, I don't teach at Wellington School. Common misconception, I teach at Wellington College, which is a boarding school in Berkshire. So there is another Wellington down in Somerset, and I sometimes get their post, but that's about it.
My sister-in-law lives in Wellington.
In New Zealand?
No, in a pair of boots.
In a pair of boots. Because constantly there in New Zealand.
She is a tiny mouse.
Lovely.
Yeah, no, it's a lovely part of the world.
It's nice, yeah. It's pretty good. I get to kind of ponce around in a cravat the entire time, much as I'm doing now. And just largely have fun, which
like
is great.
The classic classics master look.
Well, yeah, I think you've got to live up to the stereotype in some ways. I mean, as a northern monkey escaped down to the south anyway, you can just got to live up to whatever you're wearing, yeah.
Do you sort of carry sheaves of yellowing paper around?
Oh no, wax tablets.
And listeners, just to sort of fully fill out the picture, Rob was actually born with his own elbow pads.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the tweed is genetic.
Yeah.
We always ask our guests what they're worst at in the world. What would that be for you?
Modesty? No. If I'm honest, I'm actually terrible with earworms. You know, those kind of tracks that into your head and you're just sitting there kind of going... Na, 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 or an actual tune, and it's there for the entire day and you just can't get it, and then in the middle of the night you wake up screaming because night terrors, but also you finally manage to remember what this song is.
So like recognising them. I was wondering if you were bad at getting rid of them.
No. So unfortunately it's there, it's in my head the entire day, and I can never place it. I am terrible with music.
My tip for that is, if you ever need to get a song out of your head, is just replace it with Lips Inc's Funky Town. All of you are welcome at home, by the way. That's going to be in your head for the next 3 days.
That's a great earworm.
It really is, and lipworm as well. But no one can resist that little riff. It's just it's the control alt delete of earworms.
One of my greatest ever live music experiences was seeing Too Many DJs at Glastonbury, doing quite like, 'cause sometimes they play some quite hard dance music, but they played to the crowd and they kept threatening to drop Funky Town for about an hour and a half. Does there just be little sort of three note do 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 do? And so when they eventually did drop it, 3,000 people just went crazy all at once.
And that's foreplay on a music festival level.
Since you talk of foreplay, onwards to military foreplay.
Nice segue.
Thanks very much. Well, we are going to try and talk about a variety of gentlemen who tried and failed to penetrate lines.
I think we've set a tone now.
We've got a classics master on. Show a bit of restraint.
This is how I acted in my classics classes when I was 11. Yeah, yeah.
To be fair, this is how I act in my classics
classes. Actually, we just need to have a brief...
Is this the point to remind everybody that the Latin word for sheath is vagina?
Oh, I didn't know
that. Your scabbard, where you put a sword, it is a vagina.
Very interesting. Yeah. I did not know that. Don't go sticking a sword in people's vaginas unless you're Ivan the Terrible.
No, not in the current climate.
No. Yeah, Me Too is going to really stamp down on swords and vaginas.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah, it probably is.
Don't stamp on a sword, whatever you do.
At least not with your vagina.
Yeah, no.
Can you stamp with a vagina? Well, you can stamp, but only in the sort of like potato printing.
Yeah. And that would be one hell of a collage.
Would be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Get you thrown out of art class.
It's a bit more, you know. Or the Turner Prize. Either extreme.
I think, yeah. But if you can write your Latin paper like that, whoo-wee! It's astonishing.
Wow.
You know.
This is, I don't know when the cut point in that bit is going to be.
Yeah, what's the answer? It just seems to be lots of large O's. This week, ladies and gentlemen, we are talking about the world's worst military tactic. And the three of us, as you can hear, are all rugged, bare-chested military men.
Yeah.
So, of course, a lot of what we're going to be talking about is coming from our own personal memoirs.
Absolutely.
But, Barry, you're going to go first.
Yes. I just looked at some interesting tactics down through the ages to begin with. I looked at the Battle of Pelusium to begin with, mm-hmm. 525 BC. That was when the Achaemenid Empire conquered Egypt. So the Persians, led by Cambyses II, invaded Egypt, largely on the pretext that Cambyses asked the daughter of the pharaoh to marry him, and the pharaoh refused to let him have his daughter and sent another girl instead. So when Cambyses found out, this is according to Herodotus, who writes a lot of this stuff, when he found out that it happened, he's like, well, this is a good pretext to invade that handy looking country next door. By the time he invaded, though, the pharaoh who had sent the fake daughter had actually been dead for about 6 months, but he didn't let that stop him. So the Egyptians were under the leadership of Pharaoh Psamtik III, and the story goes that they managed to corner the Egyptians in a certain city at Pelusium, and Polyaenus, writing in the 2nd century AD, so you know, 700 years later, talks about the cat strategy, where Cambyses had his soldiers with paint cats on their shields and hold some cats and start sacrificing and throwing a few over the walls of the town, but knowing well that the Egyptians, massive cat fans, as indeed we all are these days online, just to get them to stop killing cats, surrendered immediately. Whether it's true or not, who knows, but they did certainly win the Battle of Pelusium and conquer Egypt. So,
going on from last week's episode with Dean, it feels like this was a tactic straight out of a point and click adventure.
It really does. Yeah, we need to get a cat. The logical answer to how to beat the Egyptians in battle is to kill cats. I also read about the Tuyuhun kingdom invading Gansu. This is in China. This is in 623. So China was ruled by the Tang dynasty at the time, mm-hmm. and the Tuyuhun were raiders from Qinghai Lake in Mongolia. So they were regularly make incursions into Imperial China, and during this incursion in Gansu, they gained the high ground. So when the Tang army showed up, they were able to shower them with arrows, and they really had the upper hand, until General Chai Shao, leading the Tang army, a man who historian C.P. Fitzgerald notes was a general of many if unorthodox resources, hit upon the idea of sending two dancing girls up on top of a nearby hill. He sent them up there with a group of musicians playing the pipa, which is an ancient stringed instrument, and the dancing girls basically just started doing a striptease.
Right.
And the Tuyuhun army, being, you know, warm-blooded men in the midst of battle, immediately lost focus and abandoned their battle lines to run to get a good view of the boobs on show on a nearby hill. And Chai Shao, his cavalry, struck down from the sides of the valley and killed about 500 of the Tuyuhun. And within 10 years, actually, the Tangs had subjugated them entirely, so they turned the tide against them. Fitzgerald's account of this ends with him saying, "It is most unwise in the midst of battle to let the mind dwell on the delights of peace." As indeed it was.
And famously lampooned in Star Trek V with Uhura's fan dance.
Is that true?
Well, it is now, because I've just said...
Yeah.
In my own head, I've connected those two disparate elements and
Thank
I've just
you.
Come up with Tang-inspired tactics for Lieutenant
That's definitely
Uhura.
Gene Roddenberry was probably a massive fan of the Tang dynasty. I also read about one of the more famous battles in ancient history, the Battle of Alesia, the decisive battle during Caesar's conquest of Gaul.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, the main source for Caesar's conquest of Gaul Gaul is Caesar's writing about how he conquered Gaul, so you've got to take everything with a pinch of salt. He sounds fucking great in his own history, like Churchill writing about World War II.
Yeah, it's a hell of a what I did on my holiday book, isn't it?
Yes, that he got back to Rome and teacher set him an essay.
Yeah.
What did you do in France? Well, let me tell you.
I could not find the bibliothèque for one.
So 52 BC, the Gauls had sort of merged under Vercingetorix, who was the chief of the Arverni. And they said, the only way chance we have of beating the Romans is if we all band together. The Romans had about 60 to 75,000 troops. The Gauls had 80,000 of them who were inside the city of Alesia, besieged by the Romans. But when the relief force arrived, that may have been as many as a quarter of a million soldiers.
Ooh, yeah.
So certainly it seems from various sources that Caesar was outnumbered 4-1 at one point during this. They don't really know where Alesia is. There's a couple of different possible locations, but they do know it was on a hill with two different rivers on two sides of it. So not ideal ground necessarily for a pitched battle, but reasonably good for setting up a siege. And Caesar decided that he was going to make it such a total siege, there was no one getting in or out. 80,000 Gauls in a town, plus women and children and regular inhabitants, they're not going to last very long with food.
Mm-hmm.
So he built a circumvallation, which is basically another wall around the wall, to complete. He didn't just have like his army battle lines encircling the city. He actually built another wall to encircle the city to stop anyone getting in or out. It was 11 Roman miles long, that's 16 kilometres, with 24 towers. But to make sure they were able to build it uninterrupted, they also dug between themselves and the city 6 metre deep trenches, 600 metres away from the walls. So they with two more trenches, 4.5 metres deep, including one they filled with water, and some ramparts, some stakes pointed towards the saddle. They built turrets left, right and centre. They basically built a wall to protect the wall they were building. And when they got news of the relief force coming, they then built the same thing facing the other direction.
Don't let Donald Trump find out about this.
That was amazing. This all happened, like the entire siege happened in the space of a month. I think it was a couple of weeks the whole thing took place. So it was an amazing feat of engineering. But they were conducting a siege while also being besieged themselves. It was amazing.
Who sieges the sieges?
Exactly. Vercingetorix, realising what was going to happen, tried to send the women and children out so that Caesar would get them out to preserve food a bit longer. Caesar, rather craftily, refused to let them through. And obviously the inability of the Gauls to communicate with each other meant they never quite knew what they were each doing. And eventually, obviously, Caesar triumphed. And Gaul was divided into three parts under him at that point. Another story that I really liked was that of Timur, a descendant of Genghis Khan. He's the man who Tamburlaine, the Christopher Marlowe play, is about.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing. He basically lived his entire career as leader of the Mongols on campaign. He'd never had a permanent capital. He was campaigning everywhere from the Mediterranean to India. And in 1398, he found himself hemmed in by the Sultan in India with his 120 war elephants. The Indians had war elephants at the time, which is an amazing phrase.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. Obviously, there's the old Geordie joke. Like, they're not war elephants, they're your elephants.
Yeah. Classic. Indeed.
Yeah. And Timur realised that they didn't stand much of a chance, but did know one thing about elephants: notoriously panicky creatures.
Yep.
So he loaded up all his camels with hay. Mm-hmm. And as soon as the elephants charged towards them, he got his men to set the hay on fire and poke the camels into the direction of the elephants. The camels, obviously, with fire on their backs, just started running towards the elephants. The elephants saw camels on fire running towards them and turned around. And suddenly the Indians had flaming camels and war elephants charging towards their own lines.
I like that this is a battlefield is drawn by Salvador Dali.
Yes. It is some sort of weird, surrealist hellscape.
Yeah.
He managed not to add insult to injury, he then seized some of the Sultan's elephants himself.
Did he load them with fiery hay?
He did raise Delhi and took them back with him when he left India. And then my second favourite story before I come to my choice is that of Hastin and Bjorn Ironside, two Vikings who were raiding in the Mediterranean in 859-860. Bjorn Ironside is quite a famous Viking. Hastin is the main focus of this story, though. First of all, they raided a bit along Iberia, but they didn't enjoy the fact that the Moors, who were in Spain at the time, had Greek fire on their boats. Basically, they had flamethrowers, which the Vikings were not really able to deal with. So they headed to the south of France, did a bit of raiding there, and then they're like, you know where we've heard has been sacked before? Rome. You know, they thought, let's have a go at Rome. So they sailed to Italy, and they got to the, and the story's told by the Norman monk Dudo of Saint Quentin. They dropped anchor off of Rome, and they sent an emissary to the mainland to say, oh, we need aid, our chieftain Hastine is very ill. And the Romans, recognising pirates when they saw them, went, no, you don't. And so they said, the emissary came back and said, no, they're not going to let us land. A couple of days later, emissary went back to Rome and said, oh, our chieftain Hastine, he's actually died now. Remember we said he was ill? He's died now. And actually, on his deathbed, he did convert to Christianity. Please, we're just mere humble merchants. We'd love to land and give him a Christian burial. We can't do that at sea. Please let us come into Rome. And so the bishop said, you know what? Okay, let's let them land. And they carried his coffin ashore, and as soon as he was placed at the feet of the bishop, Hastine, pretending to be dead, jumped out of the coffin, ripped the funeral shroud off, and producing his axe from underneath, chopped the bishop's head off, and they plundered the entire place, killing all of the male inhabitants. Except this wasn't Rome. They had landed in the town of Luna, about 200 miles northwest of Rome. Which was, I mean, I've seen pictures of it. It's quite
lovely.
It's a lovely little Mediterranean fishing village, and probably bigger than any town they'd seen in, and had more stone in it than any town they'd have seen in Denmark or Sweden or wherever they were from. But definitely, definitively was not Rome. And it has their entire campaign, they raided many other places. So they lost about 2/3 of their Vikings in the sort of the 18 months, 2 years they were there. So not very good campaigners. But I'm going to talk about Pyrrhus. Mm-hmm. Of Epirus, where we get Pyrrhic victory from. Now, Pyrrhic victory, everyone thinks, means you lose way more people than your opponent in battle, but that isn't necessarily what happened to Pyrrhus. What mainly happened is that he was a foreign potentate invading Italy, so every time they lost a battle, they won a battle, the Romans were near Rome and they had people come and replace them. So it wasn't that they just lost way more people, it's just the Romans were able to replace the people that they lost much quicker.
Basically, it's a meaningless victory.
Yes, victory. Yeah. Something that it nearly costs you more than... The way we understand means it costs you more than it's actually
worth. It's like when Newcastle beat Spurs 5-1 on the last day of the season, even though we were relegated.
Yes, exactly like that. So Pyrrhus of Epirus was basically... Epirus is sort of the northwest bit, just above Greece. And he was leading a Greek force of maybe 40,000 men, 19 war elephants. They had some elephants as well.
Again.
And this is in...
These two war elephants have got a great agent.
They get everywhere. And I mean, this is 60 years before Hannibal as well, so you know, they're still not lengthy career, the war elephants. 280 BC they land in Italy, and they face the Romans and their Italian allies at Heraclea, which is in the sort of the bridge of the foot of Italy, and they both lost somewhere between 5,000 and 15,000 each. They essentially, the Greeks won, but the Romans, the southern Italians, rallied to their cause, so they couldn't really get a foothold. They waited out winter, comes to 279, the Battle of Asculum, and the Romans, having seen the war elephants in action, had devised a way to cope with them. They basically built wagons with cranes and giant maces on them.
Wow.
Yeah, they built 300 of these things with sort of two cranes either side that they could swing and smack into the elephants. They had some things you could set on fire. They had guys throwing giant grappling hooks. It was really vicious stuff for the war elephants. There are three accounts of this battle, the Battle of Asculum. In Plutarch's account, Pyrrhus wins. In Cassius Dio's account, Rome wins. Mm-hmm. And Dionysius of Halicarnassus, he has no idea who won the battle.
Wow, sounds like the Tyson Fury Deontay Wilder fight.
Yeah, exactly. My favourite account of it is from Cassius Dio. He talks about, firstly, as they're about to enter the battle, rumour got out, it reached Pyrrhus, that the consul, Publius Decius, who was one of the consuls in the Roman Republic at the time, he was rumoured to be prepared to die in Devotio. So when the Romans were really up against it, he would sacrifice himself mid-battle, and that would, as a sacrifice to the gods, who would turn the tide in favour of the Romans, and seeing your leader be so noble would rally the Romans. So word was getting out that the Romans are feeling really up for this. And so Pyrrhus was so alarmed by this, because he had Italian allies on his side, and they were like, well, if he kills himself, then they're going to win. We won't be able to win it. He sent a guy to Publius Decius saying, don't do it. It won't be worth it. We'll capture you and we'll torture you and it'll be horrible for you. And Decius, in like the ultimate sort of drop the mic moment, said, I wasn't going to do it. I don't need to do it. We're going to win anyway. but also then Cassius Dio's account says Pyrrhus let the Romans cross the river at the point of the battle because he wanted to really test his abilities against them, which you should never do. Shouldn't go, oh, let's make it a fair fight. Let's put our oddly mismatched weapons down and fight like men. Like, no, use your advantage. You're an idiot. Pyrrhus then sends some of his men back to camp because a deployment of Roman allies had gotten to their camp and were attacking it, which then meant that the rest of the people on the front line thought the camp had fallen and they thought a retreat was taking place, so confusion just reigned in the ranks entirely, and they ended up losing the fight, according to Cassius Dio. Rome lost 6,000 men, Pyrrhus lost 3,500, and the line from Plutarch is, Pyrrhus said, if we are victorious in one more battle with the Romans, we shall be utterly ruined. And indeed, he just didn't bother. He went off to Sicily for 3 years, decided to fight the Carthaginians there, subdued them, and then decided he wanted to invade Carthage himself, but basically went rinsed all of his Greek allies for money to be able to supply it. They lost all of their support, went, well, let's go back via Italy and have a go there. At that point, the Romans had completely regrouped and he was defeated at the Battle of Beneventum in 275. So I think just generally, as a tactician, Pyrrhus...
left a lot to be desired.
Left a lot to be desired, yeah. So I'm going to pick, particularly at this one, at the Battle of Asculum, I'm going to choose Pyrrhus of Epirus as the enactor of the world's worst tactics.
Rob, you have... copious notes.
He's got a binder.
I've got a binder. Well, it's falling apart because it's an old binder. But I'm just impressed by the sheer kind of cavalcade of ancient historical battle knowledge that's just been driven
out
there.
Oh, yeah. This was all stuff I've been waiting to wheel out.
And it showed. And it was
thank you.
Barry, I think we're going to get an A for this podcast.
Yes.
Sorry, an alpha.
An alpha.
Well, I think GCSE is now to 9, so maybe an 8 at the minute.
Oh, okay. Okay, good.
Well, no, because it was interesting. I mean, because... oddly enough, I'm surprised out of all of those battles, you bet you didn't pick any of the ones that I was going to go for myself. There was a lot of battles to pick from. But, I mean, obviously when you're kind of putting thoughts together, like, some of the big hitters come up. So you're looking at things like Cyrus trying to invade the Massagetae and take on Queen Tomyris just because he wants to. He's had quite, a fairly successful reign up until this point. And then all of a sudden, in around about 525, he suddenly turns around and goes, what I'd really like to do? I'd really like to invade this country that will get me absolutely nothing. And one of his advisors...
they didn't even have any oil.
They didn't have no oil. They had, barely even had anything. And one of his advisors at that point is King Croesus of Lydia. Really rich guy, although not so much anymore, because, 40 years earlier, he'd gone to the Delphic Oracle and said, should I invade the territory of the Persians? And Delphic Oracle turned around with one of those fantastically brilliant Delphic Oracle responses of, well, if you do this, a great empire will fall.
Oh, yeah.
The very famous classic one. Classic Delphic Oracle.
Classic Magic 8 Ball.
Yeah. Ask again later. Croesus just goes for it. So Croesus tries to invade Persia, gets his arse absolutely handed to him by Cyrus, then comes and invades Lydia, captures him, and on the pyre Cyrus is going to burn Croesus alive, until at the very end a sudden shower of rain comes and puts the pyre out. So Cyrus believes that Croesus is now favoured by the gods, so he takes Croesus as an advisor, and Croesus tells him, we don't really need to invade anywhere, we don't need to do anything, you haven't got to go there. Cyrus goes for it anyway. Oh. and is absolutely trounced by the Massagetae under their Queen Tomyris. So I could have gone for that one. I could have gone for Xerxes at the Battle of Salamis, who just keeps on receiving these weird messages from Themistocles. If you read the Herodotus, Themistocles is sending messages via his slave to say, by the way, come sail your ships out into the Straits of Salamis, keep the Greek ships hemmed in, the rest of them really want to get away, but I'm completely on your side.
Yes.
And Xerxes just stands there and goes, yeah, this is entirely credible, and comes in with his fleet and boxes them in there, and then You know, they
it's a really narrow corridor.
It's an incredibly narrow corridor.
Actually, to be able to line your feet up correctly is really hard, and the Greeks are just waiting.
Exactly. This is why Themistocles wanted to fight there, because he knows that, according to Herodotus, there's about twice as many Persian ships as there are Greek ships. And he knows that if they fight them in the open straits near the Isthmus of Corinth, where all of the Peloponnesian Greeks want to fight, that they'll just get absolutely trounced. So he's engineered this battle to fight at Salamis. And Xerxes just plays along with it. And the only advisor that Xerxes has at that point that says anything against fighting at Salamis is Queen Artemisia of Halicarnassus, who's just this, again, fantastic kind of female general from the ancient world. And she stands there and goes, "You really shouldn't do this. You really shouldn't do this." They do it anyway.
And did he mansplain to her why he should?
Well, Herodotus says something like, "Whilst Xerxes respected Artemisia," and he just goes with the majority, because every other one of his advisors just says, no, just fight now, we'll trounce them. But actually, I'm going to go for somebody you mentioned earlier on.
Oh, yes.
I'm going to go for Hannibal.
Oh, yes.
And I'm actually going to go for two battles in one. Uh-huh. I'm going to be cheeky. So we're going to start off in 217 BC at the Battle of Lake Trasimene.
Yes.
Which
one
is
the Battle of Lake Trasimene.
Trasimene.
Oh, right. Just full of shampoo.
Trasimene, if you were
Or Trasimene, or however you want to pronounce it. I always say Trasimene. The context of this is that Hannibal's invaded northern Italy. He's crossed the Alps with his elephants, although most of them have died along
the
way.
He's finally
gotten here. He's managed to beat Scipio in a couple of little encounters. And then he's marching down south towards Rome. And a Roman general called Gaius Flaminius has been put in charge of trying to defeat Hannibal in open battle. And Hannibal is just much cleverer than Flaminius. Flaminius is absolutely indicative of this massive problem that Rome has throughout the entire Republican period, which is all of the power of their leading political figures is temporal. It's all limited to a single year. And so they're desperate to get as much glory as they possibly can do within that one year. Mm. So Flaminius is described in Polybius as just being headstrong, arrogant, too eager to engage. I mean, he's got this fantastic remark, which is, "Impetuosity, rashness, and irrational overconfidence are bad in an individual soldier, but even worse in a commanding officer."
Very good observation.
And Flaminius...
Who could that apply to?
Modern
political world.
Literally pick your figure. Yeah. So Hannibal actually manages to manoeuvre his army around behind Flaminius and sets up this immense ambush. Now, there's a military historian called Dodge, who calls this manoeuvre a turning manoeuvre, where effectively Hannibal manoeuvres his army between the Roman force and Rome in this very narrow pass between the lake and the hills that border the lake. Yeah. In fact, it's very similar to the way in which Thermopylae is set up.
It's an optimal ambush location.
So he's got his Balearic slingers, he's got his Numidian cavalry up on the hills, he's got his standard Spanish infantry that he's acquired on the march through, just pointing on the top of the hill, and he just sees this column of Romans marching up this narrow pass, and I could just imagine him sitting at the top of the hill just rubbing his hands in glee that he's just being about to descend on Flaminius. And Flaminius just plays entirely into his hands. It doesn't help that Polybius also tells us the morning is incredibly foggy, so the Romans can't see anything that they're doing as well. So all of a sudden, in the midst of
all like one arm on each other's shoulder.
They're kind of, "Dave, is that you?" And just can't see anything. And then Flaminius marches into the ambush, completely, seemingly unawares that Hannibal has done this, and is absolutely slaughtered. Polybius has this fantastic description about the battle, how some of the Romans just flee headlong into the lake and drown in their own armour. But, I mean, to put it in context, you were saying that 6,000 Romans died at Epirus. 15,000 Romans are killed at Lake Trasimene. And it totally destroys the Roman mentality. When the battle is announced in Rome, the outcome of the battle, the senator who announces it says, he stands up on the rostrum, he says to the people, "There has been a battle. It's been a big one. we've lost it.
Right, leaving out a lot of detail.
Yeah, I mean, Polybius actually writes the clause, so the last two Latin words in the clause are Victi Summus. So actually you don't hear the outcome of the battle until the very last end. And I always imagine the senator diving off and running away. Just like, we lost, charges off.
No further questions.
No further questions. There'll be no time for questions at the end of this press conference. But yeah, so and it throws the entire Roman state into absolute carnage. So to the extent that they decide for about a year that they're just not going to fight Hannibal in open battle.
It is quite like it's a Benny Hill type thing. They're just chasing them around going, fight me.
Exactly that. So they appoint a chap called Quintus Fabius Maximus Cunctator. He gets given the nickname Cunctator, meaning the delayer.
Yes.
And for virtually an entire year, he just refuses to fight.
Yeah.
So
I think there's an episode of Yes, Prime Minister called The Fabian Strategy where they just basically refuse to do what the Prime Minister asks the civil service to do. They just keep delaying it until it's no longer the thing he wants to do.
Correct. And Hannibal tries to poke Fabius into fighting. So, for example, Hannibal, according to Livy, is just burning all of the land that Fabius doesn't own. So he's burning absolutely everything around the Roman field, except for anything that's got a little sign saying, guys, you know, Fabius Cunctator lives here. And even that will not push Fabius into fighting.
Wow, that's a level of restraint.
It is a level of restraint, but unfortunately his popularity in Rome plummets.
Of course, yeah.
Everybody just thinks of him as being a coward. Everybody says, this is not the Roman way.
Yeah.
So after a year, they get rid of him and they replace him with the two elected consuls for 216, who are Lucius Aemilius Paulus and Gaius Terentius Varro. And again, those guys just decide, what we're going to try for now is actual heated battle.
They are like dumb and fucking dumb.
Yeah, I mean,
Paulus and Varro.
I mean, to be fair to Paulus is the one who doesn't really want to fight. Yeah. Paulus is the one sitting there going, we don't really need to engage. Fabius has done us well so far.
Yeah.
But Varro, because he's become consul, because he's slightly younger, because he's headstrong, he is just, again, desperate for glory. And all of this leads up to the disaster, which is the Battle of Cannae in 216. Yeah. And what happens here is just hilarious. So both consuls are leading the army, and according to some of the sources, this is a huge army. I mean, we've got numbers about 48,000 infantry, 6,000 cavalry on the Roman side. Polybius, who's one of the two sources, says it's even bigger than that, with 80,000 Roman soldiers.
Because they've used that year, that famous
Yeah, they've used that year to recruit. To recruit. And one of the things that's always struck me as remarkable is that none of the Italian allies states give up. They all stick with Rome, and it's the one thing that Hannibal can't really account for.
Yeah.
So at Cannae, the two consuls are alternating command day by day, which is a really brilliant tactic for leading an army, I've always thought.
So it's like, I get to give an order, then you get to give an order.
And on the day of the battle, Varro is the one in command, and apparently, according to the Livy, without any consultation with Paulus, basically rises to Hannibal's bait. Hannibal goads the Romans into fighting again by sending out his Numidian cavalry to kind of poke the bear. And Varro marches across the river into the battle. And the way Hannibal set up his battle line is genius. So he's got Numidian cavalry on one flank, he's got his allied cavalry on the other side, and in the middle he's got his kind of his Celts and his Spaniards. And the Roman army does exactly what the Roman army tries to do all of the time, which is this massive infantry mincing machine.
Yeah.
And Varro just sends his main army down the middle, straight at the heart of Hannibal's army. And Hannibal's designed his line in what Polybius calls a moon formation, so that as it starts off in a kind of convex setup, as the Romans march into the centre, it becomes concave. So the Spaniards and the Celts in the middle are giving ground, but their battle line is not breaking.
Well, that's really clever.
Yeah, and what happens is the two flanks with the cavalry then just encircle. So have you ever seen Zulu?
Yes.
Where the boar character is explaining the Zulu tale, it is the head and horns of the buffalo, but with a better accent.
It's possibly the first ever pincer movement in military history, and it's brilliant.
It is absolute genius. So the Roman army is just encircled by these two sweeping lines of cavalry who've managed to beat off the Roman cavalry, what there was of it, encircle and just slaughter these Romans in the centre of this battlefield. It is brutal. It is crazy. There's this brilliant moment in the Livy where Paulus is sitting on a rock and Lentulus, one of the military tribunes, rides up to him and says, "Take my horse! You can still get away, Paulus! Get back to Rome!" And Pouch just says, there's very little point. I'm sitting here, but you can deliver a message for me. Go back and tell the Romans that Fabius was right. and that's the end of the battle. And it is wholesale slaughter. At this point, Hannibal should have won the war.
Yeah.
And this is the reason why I picked this battle in particular, because it's a cock-up tactically on both the Romans' front, but also on Hannibal's front. If Hannibal had marched on Rome at that point, he would have probably conquered Rome. And his brother, Margot, who is standing next to him at the time...
His brother's called Margot?
Margot, yes.
Yeah. Oh, a member of the French Resistance.
Yes, constantly wearing a beret and only saying things once.
Yes.
And this one time he says, Hannibal, you know how to win a battle, you don't know how to exploit it.
Yeah.
And Livy's got this remark, which is just, that one day everybody agrees saves Rome's future. Because Hannibal... For probably in his own head, very good tactical reasons. He wasn't set up with a siege army. He'd been on campaign for a couple of years. His communication lines were stretched. He wasn't getting reinforcements the way he wanted to. But if he'd marched on Rome then, Carthage would have won the Second Punic War.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't be talking about people like, you know, Augustus. We wouldn't be talking about... Because it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
Carthage would have been the Mediterranean superpower that Rome became.
The bonkers thing is that the Second Punic War is something like 219 to 203, 202.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is 216.
This is 216, yeah.
So, like, another 14 years. Basically, yeah, for a decade, he's just wandering around Italy.
Yeah, he's wandering around Italy, watching his brothers and fellow Carthaginians largely let him down.
Yes.
The Romans realise that what they can do is they can just starve him out. So they send an army over to Spain under Scipio and cut off his supply lines. The Roman navy, because they won Sicily in the First Punic War, the Roman navy is controlling the Mediterranean, so they can't sail support
from Carthage to Rome
to send reinforcements to support that way. So Cannae's brilliant. Cannae should have been the greatest victory ever. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's a tremendous victory, but if he'd acted at that point, if he'd followed his brother's advice, he would have carried the war. And 14 years later, at the Battle of Zama, Scipio Africanus, who's largely just copied all of Hannibal's tactics, uses them against Hannibal and the Carthaginians at Zama. And
it's like Jose Mourinho facing off against Pep Guardiola.
It's just crazy. It's absolutely crazy. You just imagine Hannibal's there. They go, this looks vaguely familiar, but usually it's from the other way round. So for me, for both the cock-up of the Roman command structure, which was there throughout the entire Republican period, and the failure of Hannibal to capitalise on his actual victory, for me, if you want tactical cock-uppery, Cannae is the one.
To begin with, Scotland.
In every World Cup they've ever been in.
Oh, brutal.
True.
There was the entire kind of anthem, which was "Don't come home too soon." That was not our my favourite Scottish World Cup.
It
didn't set the agenda or the tone that we were looking for.
They should have had Scottish football supporters in the audience with massive white feathers, because that was essentially "Come back with your shield or on it" as a pop song.
That's true.
So the Battle of Stirling Bridge in 1297, near where my beloved wife is from. And the English Earl John de Warenne's very well-equipped, large army were trapped on a narrow bridge by William Wallace's 15,000 unarmed, lightly... by William Wallace's 15,000 unarmoured, lightly armed Scots.
Unarmed, not a great way to fight a battle.
No. Confident, though.
Yeah.
And the bridge was chosen as a point of engagement by Earl de Warenne, even though the river could easily have been forded just a few miles upstream. But no, there's a bridge there, chaps, so we're going to go over that. And they were routed by Wallace and his troops.
Of course they were.
Classic English arrogance.
Wow, that is... Yeah, the bridge is there to be used. It would be rude not to.
Yes, otherwise...
It's like they've opened a doorway for us, we've got to step through.
What is the point of infrastructure if you don't use it? Back in ancient China in 1046 BCE, there was the Battle of Mui between several cows. Jiang Qi was the strategist of the army of the Shang dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
he had about 530,000 men to defend the capital, but
sounds like enough.
Yeah, to further secure his victory, he gave weapons to about 170,000 slaves to protect the capital. However, those slaves didn't want to fight for the corrupt Shang dynasty.
Give me
instead.
Slave uprising?
No, slave defection.
Even better.
They defected to the Zhou army instead.
So good.
And that greatly lowered the morale of the troops, even Shang troops, even more. So when engaged, many of the Shang soldiers didn't fight and just held their spears upside down.
I was on a tube yesterday. As the doors were closing, a lady hopped to get in, stuck her foot in the door so it couldn't close fully, and so the doors reopened and she climbed on, and the driver said, a reminder to passengers, please do not try and obstruct the doors with any parts of your body, it can do damage to the doors. And then there was sort of like a 5 second pause, and then he went, actually, I've decided I'm going to regulate the service here. We're going to be waiting here for a minute or two to regulate the service. You can all thank the lady who put her foot in the door. It's like, wow, that is passive aggressive, and definitely something you could only do on a Sunday on London Transport. You could not get away with that in rush hour.
No. But and the woman who's not carrying a spear.
Yeah. That was very much the driver turning his spear upside down and refusing to do his job.
I do love it when tube drivers have very pointed commentary on the actions of the passengers.
Yeah.
Next we go to the year 1857, and in India, the British Empire, they had just bought the new Patton 3 Enfield rifle. And it was to be issued to all of the Empire's troops and replace the older, less efficient models. And listen, on the surface, no big deal, guys.
Nice gun. Nice shiny gun.
Yeah. However, back in those days, the cartridges weren't made of brass. They were made of paper. And to load one, you had to bite the end off it, very much like a cigar. Again, literally no big deal. Problem is, though, the lubricating lard smeared on the cartridges was made from animal fat, which was obtained from either pigs or cows. Guess the religion of most of the troops who fought in the Empire. That's right, guys, Muslims and Hindus. So this basically led to the Sepoy Rebellion, or the Sepoy Mutiny. These Indian soldiers, known as Sepoys, refused to use these cartridges. They rose up and began a bloody rebellion that lasted 13 months and led to enormous amounts of bloodshed, and was seen in many ways as the genesis of the Indian independence movement led by Mohandas Gandhi.
It was, yeah, it had been getting a bit hot over there and a bit tinderboxy, and that was very much the pig's fat that broke the camel's back.
The fiery camel. Next up, more ridiculous behaviour from the British Army, to World War II, our favourite place for derring do and nonsense ideas. Developed by our special operations executive.
Oh, we love those guys.
Yeah. They came up with the idea of rat bombs.
What?
Yeah, I've seen these are hilarious.
So they were going to use rat carcasses, stuff them with explosives, and then sow the German coal supplies with them. So in the hope that when the rats were shoveled into boilers along with the coal, they would detonate as bombs.
That would ruin
German infrastructure.
They've taken Cambyses' cat bombs and just...
Yeah.
Well, that is amazing. The rats have to be dead.
Well, yeah, how else are you going to get explosives inside a rat?
I don't know, I sense a fun board game. That's so stupid. Why don't they just make fake coal?
Well, maybe they had more access to rat carcasses
than coal.
Than Bakelite. I mean, you're going to make your fake coal out of Bakelite. You're not going to use good, hard-earned British coal.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's very true.
It's the war on!
It's an explosive agas all over Germany.
They've got an endless supply of rats.
You're never more from 6 feet from one.
You're in war time, you're never more than 6 feet from an exploding rat. From now, for more batshittery, the good old CIA. So during the Cold War, they were very much into their PSY, just using everything they had in their bag to intimidate the enemy. Chief amongst this was a gentleman called Edward Lansdale, who was absolute batshit mental.
Yeah.
He learned Vietnamese just to write a best-selling astrological almanac that he then smuggled into enemy terror. That he smuggled into enemy territory, so he'd know what advice the Viet Cong were getting from their local soothsayers.
He was kind of the CIA Mystic Meg.
Yes, he was. But the thing is, it wasn't very subtle. So there were pieces of advice written in the soothsaying manual, such as, June is the perfect month to replace all your commanding officers with unarmed children. Little too on the nose.
Yeah, it's like Trump's Twitter feed, this. Yep. He learned Vietnamese purely to write a best-selling book.
But look, it became a bestseller, so it wasn't an entire loss.
Do you think he was actually, like, not really fussed about the military outcome, but more about his royalties?
Yeah, five-star review on Amazon.
Yeah, translated into 50 different languages.
Didn't want to be a general, I wanted to be a Vietnamese astrologer. Next, his genius was seen in the Philippines. He became more aware of local myths surrounding the Aswang, which is an evil...
Aswang.
So we'll have a moment, lads.
To be fair, I was going to go with an Aswad-based joke.
No, me too.
Aswang.
Yeah, well, it's an evil vampire creature that uses a pointed prehensile tongue to drain its victim's blood. And obviously, when it's there, you can't turn around. thanks. Enjoy that, 10 listeners. So, basically, when a communist unit had adopted a virtually impregnable position atop a hill, he leapt into action. He began spreading rumours of the Aswang in the local area, and to sell it to hardened soldiers, he needed convincing evidence. And he went the whole hog. He set up an ambush. He captured the last man in the enemy patrol, punctured his neck with two holes, vampire style, held the body upside down by the heels, drained it of blood, and then put the corpse back on the trail.
Wow. He's gone from writing, like, fortune-telling books in Vietnam to creating a myth of a vampire in the Philippines.
Yeah, things accelerated quickly. And to be fair to him, it worked. But I don't know whether it's because the people believed the myth or because they were like, oh, the Americans are angry.
What was the street in Monopoly with the vampire? We did in our Monopoly board episode.
Yes.
It's the one between Leicester Square and Piccadilly.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Never mind.
But my selection, we're going to stay in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam. Now, before the Americans came in and sorted it all out, Vietnam was known as French Indochina, was administrated as part of the French Empire. Obviously, from 1945 onwards, the Viet Minh, who were the precursor to the Viet Cong, tried to throw the French out of there. Enter General Henry Navarre. He had a cunning plan to turn the tide in this fight. He would put his men in such an intensely vulnerable position that the Viet Minh wouldn't be able to stop themselves from attacking them. What could go wrong, guys? So it's not quite as mental as it sounds, basically, because the French military technology was so sophisticated compared to what these Vietnamese villagers had. He thought, listen, we can let them come onto us, and then we'll destroy them with our better...
Yeah,
the face on Rob at the moment, the man who understands military tactics, is like, no, that is such an idiot attempt.
Let's cut a leg off and then challenge them to football.
Precisely. So he popped his army in the middle of a large valley while leaving the surrounding mountains completely unoccupied.
He really going for it, isn't he?
On top of that, the valley was on the very fringe of where he could get air support, so it was hard to get reinforcements and resupplies, and that was impossible during the rainy season. You couldn't have anyone parachute in to help out. So, essentially, the enemy would come across his army absolutely convinced that his army was helpless, because here's the thing, it was.
Yeah.
And the backup plan of earning Vietnamese pity did not go well, and they slaughtered him mercilessly. The Viet Minh commander Vo Nguyen Giap simply dragged artillery from where he could find it, patiently waited for the rainy season, and bombarded the living shit out of Navarre.
Wow, that is stunning work.
Yeah.
That's a classic French. I don't know, he probably has the French that felt at home losing a battle. They're like, we're in a position of strength and superiority. This is not our usual thing.
Especially in the rain. If the Six Nations has taught me anything.
Yes.
Our suggestions are Barry's of the father of Pyrrhic victories, Pyrrhus. Rob's selection of Hannibal's ability of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. And Henry Navarre, his ability to snatch defeat from the jaws of defeat by putting himself in enormous trouble. I'm going
Big hitters.
You're big hitters.
Punchy.
Yeah.
Except for Navarre.
I'm going to say no to Pyrrhus because victories.
Yeah, and actually, I think he'd feel happy not winning this because it would feel like a victory.
It feels like a victory. Yeah, indeed, yeah.
Feel like a victory.
Yeah. Exactly, and he stood the test in time. So it's between Hannibal, a good commander doing something stupid over a decade and a half, or General Henry Navarre, a stupid general doing something stupidly for a year. And I think, because Hannibal is such a talented general, and because it's more a matter of just not striking at the opportune moment, and because mine is the epitome of Gallic military incompetence, I'm going to pick General Henri Navarre.
Yes, well done him.
Well done him. Before we go, it's time for the world's worst news of the week. We go to Massachusetts, where two firefighters are being treated for smoke inhalation after their fire truck caught fire, setting the fire station they were in also alight. The blaze broke out at 2:40 in the morning, and the pair were forced to fight the fire without any gear, as it had been started inside the truck where all of the gear was.
Who will fight the fireman's fight? Who will fight the firefighter's fire? That is amazing. I love that story.
Yeah. So before we go, Rob, where can our listeners find you, and what can they find you doing when they get there?
Well, right now I'm off up to central London to have some food and drink because I got earned it. And then after that, I am going to be knocking around Berkshire, but I don't think anybody wants to come and visit me.
I think they might find you on Twitter quicker.
Yeah, so Twitter is the way to get it. So if you want more facts about the ancient world and sci-fi and or you know just interesting tidbits, especially on Thursdays, follow me at @DocCrom on Twitter.
Lovely stuff. Until next time, we are all off to expose ourselves in a Vietnamese valley, and I hope it comes off A-OK. Bye.
Not for the first time.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.